Thank you very much. What I'll try and do today is, it's going to be a lot of case studies. I think it's the best way to explain what we do is by way of case study. So you've got some real life examples. I can't really disclose the names of many of them, because a lot of them are quite sensitive, and I don't think the clients would appreciate that. So if you just start, what the areas that I want to cover today. What does a forensic accountant do? You know, it's a word that's bandied around an awful lot, but what is it that we do? There's a little bit of a boring bit, I'm afraid, and that's the framework that we operate in. There is a bit of a framework and some rules and regulations that we have to comply with, and I think it's relevant to explain that to you. There's a whole section there on specific case studies, which I want to go through. Again, it's a good way of explaining what the issues are that we deal with and what we do to overcome those. I want to look at the evidence that we use, because quite surprisingly, it's not always numbers. And actually, some of the best evidence we use in cases is just general research and understanding of the businesses. And a final session, it's actually headed, how do you become a forensic accountant? But I think more, it's what are the qualities that we look for when we're seeking to recruit new accountants into the team. Start with what does a forensic accountant do? I think it's one of those phrases, actually, that's it's surrounded in mystique. You know, it conjures up all sorts of images. But from my point of view, what I really enjoy about the whole role is that everything's transactional. No case is ever the same. And we get to know businesses really well. You have to really understand the subject matter. Quite frankly, there's times when the work is extremely boring. When you're poring over tens of thousands of documents and you've got to really get into them, it's not great fun. What is great fun is when you find the golden bullet, the real crucial piece of evidence, and the point that's going to win the case for your client. The other thing that's interesting as well is that what we do, we follow bad news. You know, somebody only appoints a forensic accountant if something's gone wrong. So nobody ever wants to appoint us, but hopefully they like us when they get us. I thought I'd start with just a few pictures, actually, which sort of describe some of the things that we do. As I say, we follow bad news. And we've got a picture there of a burning factory. And to us, that's a potential case. There's a loss of profits there. There's something we can help our client or potential client with, whether that's the company that's being the victim of the fire or potentially an insurance company that might be involved in that process. A lot of what we do is office-based and sat behind computer screens and whatever else, but we do get the chance to travel on occasion. And just a couple of places that we've been to in the last couple of years. The first one there is Monte Carlo. As the partner in the team, I obviously took that one. I thought that was quite a good one to go for. Second one is Uganda. And that was actually a fraud investigation for one of our British-based clients, so that was quite interesting. And this rather stern-looking gentleman on the right, I think it's quite a sobering reminder of what it's all about, really, because a lot of the work that we do can potentially go into court, and we can be cross-examined by barristers and QCs. That's the part of the job that I'm not such a fan of, but fortunately it doesn't happen too often. The other interesting thing now is, although he's dressed up in his wig and gowns and all the rest of it, most civil courts in this country now, all of that is now gone. It's people wearing suits rather than the wigs and gowns. It's still retained in the criminal courts, but it's the pomp and ceremony part of it looks as though it's subsided a little. Okay, so just going through what we do. What does forensic mean? And actually, forensic is means relating to the court or pertaining to the court. And then forensic accounting, by definition, is helping the court with accounting issues in the context of disputes. It gets called many things. You might hear a term, litigation support, forensic accountant, dispute resolution. They're all one of the same things. And essentially, the work that we do falls into three main areas. The first is investigations, and I'll come onto these in more detail as we go through. The other is being asked to give an opinion or an expert opinion on a particular matter, an accounting matter. And the final area that we get involved in is damages and quantum, i.e. how much is this claim worth or how much does the fraud cost the business? So looking at investigations fall into quite a number of areas. And I'll just go through some of the key headings. Allegations of fraud, where you think a fraud has happened within your organisation, you need to get to the bottom of that. You need to identify what has happened, who's to blame, whether you can recover any losses. Financial investigations. We're living in a world now where the regulatory framework is becoming quite onerous and it seems to be getting worse and worse. And as the regulations get harder and harder and more robust and stronger, inevitably there's more investigations that fall out of those. So we see quite a number of inquiries arising from the regulatory framework. tax investigations. We work closely with our colleagues in our tax investigations team on tax investigations. There's clearly the technical tax side, which I frankly don't understand. And then there's quite often the forensic element. So we work well together on those. We've had a lot of discussion over the last 12 months or so around the UK Bribery Act and the implications of that. In the US, we've got the FCPA, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, very similar and very onerous. There's inevitably going to be quite a number of cases that will arise out of that. So again, it's another opportunity and another area where I think as forensic accountants, we will start to move into. And money laundering, it's been around for a long time in terms of on the radar, and particularly now where on criminal matters where we can trace through assets and the courts have got the right to trace through those assets, it's becoming a very, very important area. And it's for us, a lot of it is tracing where the funds have gone, and we're asked to do that on quite a number of occasions. But in terms of the investigations, we can actually break it down into a number of areas that we need to address. On most occasions, there's always a quantum aspect, you know, how much was the fraud or how much was the loss. But essentially, in the investigation, what we're looking to do is who did what? What did they actually do? Where did they do it? When did they do it? How much did they cost us? And why did they do it? I think the why is normally quite straightforward. It's normally because they want to fund a lavish lifestyle. But we'll take you through a case study that we dealt with. This is a case that we were instructed on. I gave evidence on this case in the civil courts, and the outcome for our client was very positive. But our client is a manufacturer of household goods. Probably half the room has one of their goods in their house, I'm sure. And what happened was that over the years, they'd moved their manufacturing base from the UK into Europe and then subsequently to the Far East. And they had a process for all the plant machinery where they had to buy tools that fitted on to manufacture the individual components. And it's a huge budget. It was something like a £30 or £40 million budget. And they did an internal review. And this was no suspicion of fraud at this stage. And they had a concern that some of these contracts that they had with the suppliers of toolings were a little on the high side. They're paying too much. So it was really a contract review. But the person who was leading that team and responsible for that team was quite evasive in that review and that investigation, which aroused a certain amount of suspicion. And it was at that point where we were called in. So the who part of this was the individual was the senior procurement officer within the company. And what he actually did was he actually took bribes from the suppliers. And the way in which that became a loss to our clients, apart from just being plain wrong, was that the contract prices were increased by the supplier to accommodate the amount of this bribe. Where was he doing it? He was doing it with pretty much each of the five or six suppliers they had. And it actually, as the manufacturing base had moved from Europe to the Far East, it continued with new suppliers. It did it very successfully. He had been doing it for quite a number of years. Now, the how is actually quite interesting. The how he did it, he set up with his spouse a series of companies which we were able to identify. It's a matter of public record. And it was interesting because these companies were turning over quite substantial amounts of money. He was listed as a director, he and his wife, and they were both shareholders. And it was all consultancy income in the tooling industry was the activity. We thought, well, we can't have this full-time job with our client and do all of this. The businesses on the face of it were entirely legitimate. They paid taxes, they had expenditure, they paid themselves as directors and took dividends. One interesting point on the fraud, obviously the amount of corporation tax that were paid were clearly proceeds of crime, and we did contemplate whether we could pursue the Inland Revenue for... but we thought better of it in the end. And that's what he did. And why? Well, it was very clear, very, very lavish lifestyle. So what did we do? Well, first of all, the first part was actually identifying the existence of these companies and that process. Then with the lawyers, we managed to identify from the limited disclosure at that point that we had that this couple had over 80 bank accounts. They thought it was quite normal, as you would. Either in their name or in the company's name. We then, and this is this, I mentioned at the start, there's some parts of our work are quite tedious, and my team will certainly vouch for that on this occasion. We were able to get access to over 50 of those bank account statements for a six-year period, and we had to analyse those statements in some real detail over a six-year period. And to put this into context, there were tens of thousands of lines of data. And basically what we did with all of that information, we were able to track the movements between accounts, because obviously money was being, to try and disguise the source, was being moved from one account to another it was in the UK and overseas. And what we ultimately got to in the process of our report was a position where we identified the net receipts going into those bank accounts after taking account of all the fluctuations and the net expenditure. We were then able to look at the net receipts and say, well, we know that's their income from employment, we know that's their income from other sources, the known income. And what we had was a shortfall of somewhere in the order of £5 million, which couldn't be identified, and they couldn't identify, or wouldn't identify, they clearly knew where it had come from as the trial progressed. What we then also had to do was look at all of their assets, and it's the assets that we could identify. So we'd look at houses, we'd look at, we've obviously gone through the bank accounts, other investments, pensions, and just see how could they have got to that position just from legitimate earnings, and clearly they couldn't. This was all put together in a report. I was cross-examined in court for, I think it was 1.5 days in total. Rather interestingly, the QC that cross-examined me wasn't interested or didn't really pursue individual transactions. It was all about the approach that we applied in reaching our conclusions. And clearly what he was doing was trying to seek to find a flaw in the methods that we'd used. Fortunately, he didn't. There was subsequently a court order for circa £5 million that they had to repay. So crime doesn't pay. I mentioned the term crime there. It's rather interesting that there's never been a criminal conviction for this, despite the size of the fraud. The next area I want to look at, the second area, is expert opinions. And we're asked to give an opinion on certain disputes. And there's a whole variety. The list is endless, and it's just trying to summarise what the key ones are. We might have to give an opinion on a financial reporting dispute. Should something have been disclosed in a particular way, or is it misleading? Business valuations, it's becoming an increasingly big area of work for all forensic accountants now. It's valuations in the context of a dispute. So ordinarily, it would be things like shareholder disputes, areas where you've got a director who's left and you've got to buy back the shares. And rather concerning, I find rather concerning, increasingly now, in matrimonial disputes, we see a lot of work where one of the main assets of an estate for a couple that are separating may be the shares in the family business. So that's another area. Shareholder and partnership disputes we've mentioned. Transaction disputes, this obviously covers your completion account disputes, your breach of warranty claims. And in fact, on the breach of warranty claim, I've just last week was giving evidence in court on a warranty dispute. So I'm still waiting to find the result of that at the moment. So breach of warranty on contracts generally, and professional negligence. Clearly we're all professionals. We're all aware that clients who have a dispute with us view us as having deep pockets. You know, it goes whether you're an accountant or whether you're a lawyer or any profession. So again, we do see work in that area. This particular case, sorry, if you just bear for one moment, was a case that we dealt with. Our client was actually an American manufacturing company, and they were criticised publicly for the way in which they structured their accounts, and particularly some of the restructuring costs. And our role was to look at those restructuring costs on their European businesses and actually give the court an opinion as to whether they were properly disclosed or not. So what this actually involved, a lot of research into US GAAP. This is prior to international accounting standards, and what should or should not be treated as restructuring. And then we had to analyse each of the individual entries and reach an opinion as to whether it was properly classified or inappropriately classified. But that's quite a long process. It wasn't just a case of looking at a set of data. You had to get underneath the skin of all of the individual transactions. And then we presented our report, which gave an opinion that a proportion of them were legitimate and a proportion wasn't. Where it wasn't, then we have to do the next stage and say what should have happened and what was the disclosure point that, that should be applied. We're back to the burning factory. Damages and quantum. This is probably the, one of the key areas for us as forensic accountants. This is where we're trying to quantify what the loss has been. What is the loss of profit? What is the difficulty with it is you're trying to quantify something that has never happened and will never happen because of the event. So it could be business interruption as a result of something like this, a factory fire, loss of profits generally, a breach of warranty, a breach of contract, or even in the context of a professional negligence claim, what is the loss? Come back to a case study. This case study, I absolutely love this case. It wasn't a particularly big case, and it certainly wasn't complex, but the subject matter was interesting. We were instructed by an insurance company. The insurance company acted for an international bank, and this bank had suffered a loss as a result of a software failure. And it was actually on their trading floor of the international currency tradings that they do. And what had happened was they were trying to do this software update across three centres, one in the UK in London, one in the Far East, and one in North America. North America and the Far East, it worked perfectly, but the one in the UK failed miserably. And what happened was that as a result of this failure, the individual traders lost all record of current transactions that were taking place. So they had no record of the monies that should have either been coming in or going out, and as a result suffered interest and penalties on those contracts. But when you're dealing in tens of millions of pounds worth of currency contracts, the interest and penalties, even for a day, are quite significant. Again, not too difficult to quantify. The more difficult part was actually trading was suspended for 48 hours on that floor, and it's trying to establish what was the loss. And so you have to look back at historical data. What is the volume of transactions? Once we'd settled it and we'd agreed it with the bank, we helped insurers then seek to recover that money from the software company as well. So there was another part to this. The one thing I found particularly interesting about this case, though, the similarity would be football teams. The manager who was in charge of this trading floor was a chap in his mid-30s, very senior role. The individual traders on the trading floor were all between the ages of 19 and 24, and it was absolutely manic. There was telephones going everywhere, and we were just talking about this, and he said that the reality is that these guys can only do this job for 5 or 6 years. The good ones get out after a period of time, and they just can't maintain that level of pressure. So, and they were paid huge amounts of money, a lot more than he was, although he was responsible for the whole department. So it was from that point of view, it was also very interesting. And so we have to do some of the boring bits, but I think it's appropriate to do that. Looking at the framework that we operate in, it's not an overt structure, but there are certain rules that we have to operate within. We've got what we call the civil procedure rules, and that governs cases that are going through the civil courts in the UK. There's certain statutes and laws we have to take into consideration that might either in the way in which we conduct ourselves or also in the way that it might have an impact on the case itself. There are certain legal precedents from previous cases that are relevant, and just regulations and professional ethics just generally are very important. But even though we've got that framework surrounding us, there's still a huge amount of scope for us to be innovative and creative in the way in which we do our work. And that's actually very important given the nature of our work. I won't read all of this out, but essentially the civil procedure rules were introduced back in 1999, and it followed a review that was undertaken by Lord Wolfe. And for those who are old enough to remember, it was the Wolfe reforms at the time. And one of the issues that faced accountants and other experts in court was you could be quite partisan to your clients, and that took up a huge amount of court time. So you'd write a report that was favourable to your client, so then it was down to the court to get to the bottom of what the truth was, really. What the civil procedure rules have done is place an obligation on the expert, such that the obligation that you have and the duty you have is the duty is to the court, not to your client. So you have to be in a position where you tell the whole truth, and it's got to be impartial. It's always very difficult sometimes because you know more about your client than you will do about the opposition. But experts do face very strong criticism if they breach that regulation, and it's public criticism as well. So now, and it's one of the reasons why you're rarely called into court now to give evidence, because the obligation is to the court. One would hope, when doing your report, if you see something or come across something that has an adverse effect on your client's case, you would notify your instructing solicitors and you'd deal with it that way, rather than leaving it to the point where you're in court and costs are being incurred. That covers the litigation process, the court process. But there are other ways of resolving disputes. And increasingly now, parties we're seeing don't want to go through court. It's expensive, it's time-consuming, it's not pleasant. They want to resolve the dispute. And they're prepared to make a compromise on the outcome. And there's a number of areas that we can look at. There's a process called mediation, which I have to say I'm a huge fan of. And what mediation does, it brings the parties together, hopefully into the same building, and you appoint a mediator who will try and mediate the case and try and get agreement between the parties. He's not there, or he or she is not there to pass judgment and to give an opinion. It is simply to try and identify parts of the two cases and see if there are areas where they can start talking and hopefully narrow some of the issues, and then hopefully reach a settlement. The courts generally insist that the mediation happens, and as I say, I'm a huge supporter of it. And actually, think about it logically. If you've got lawyers writing to each other, the letters are pretty vindictive, they're a bit nasty, they're not very pleasant with each other, and you're obviously in dispute, that there's quite a gap between the parties. But if you can actually bring them into the room, one room together, you can sometimes reach agreement. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes it's very difficult. The normal format for a mediation is that the parties all sit round a table at the start of the day and they go through a process where they all say, we're here to try and settle the claim. It's quite programmed, really, but that is the intention. I have been to mediations where we've had to separate, the parties have had to be separated, and you can't put them in the room. And one particular case last year, which was really sad, it was a shareholder dispute, so it was a share valuation dispute, but it was actually a father and son dispute, to bring this down, and we couldn't have them in the same room. The other point that there was that even if one of them wanted to go to the bathroom, we had to check that the coast was clear and they weren't going to see each other. So, needless to say, that didn't settle on the day, but we tried. You've also got expert determination, and many of you will come across expert determination in the context of completion account disputes on transactions. Some valuations are done on that basis. I personally think they're great. I love doing them. It's the one time as an accountant where I can act as judge and jury, and your decision's binding. So personally, I quite like that. The other big area, and it's becoming increasingly important, is international arbitration. And there's various centres, and it is effectively litigation, but under outside of the remit of the courts. And there's various centres around the world that do this. We've got the ICC, which is International Chamber of Commerce, who are based in Paris. We've got the London Chamber of Commerce, who run a similar scheme. We've got the United Nations Commission as well. We've got new centres developing in Dubai and Singapore. And the real attraction for parties here is that this is entirely behind closed doors. This does not get into the public domain. Litigation, when you litigate through the courts, certainly in the UK and most other jurisdictions, it's public knowledge. So if Company A wants to sue Company B, it's a matter of public record. Dealing with it this way, you keep it out of the public domain. The equivalent of the judge is the arbitrator, who will be appointed by both parties, and he will effectively, or she will effectively, fulfil that role of judge. So that's becoming increasingly important, and it is the secretive element, I think, that is most important. As I said, certain statutes have a relevance for us. You know, clearly the Companies Act, you can see that would obviously have an impact, and there's various others in there. I won't necessarily go through them all, but Proceeds of Crime Act, Police and Criminal Evidence Act, Criminal Justice Act, particularly around the criminal side of what we do. And there's a number of precedents as well that we have to consider, and the ones I want to address are the measure of damages. And this is from a case back in 1880, and it's still relevant today. The measure of damages in a case is that sum of money which will put the party that has been injured or who has suffered in the same position as he would have been in if he had not sustained the wrongdoing for which he is now getting his compensation or reparation. Basically, what it means is, to the extent that we can possibly do it, we should identify a financial compensation that compensates for you for the loss. You're not there to make a profit out of it. We see that in the US. It's a slightly different system in the US where it can be much more punitive. But in the UK, it's to put you back into the position that you were in, but for the damage. And then we look at it, some of the specifics. Damages for breach of contract. It's to put you back into the same position that you would have been if the contract had been performed. And what we have to do as forensic accountants is, on a breach of contract dispute, is look at that contract and try and establish what would have happened had that contract run its normal course and been applied. We've got damages in tort or things like negligence. The injured party should be placed, as far as money can do it, in the same position as they would have been had the tort not been committed. And again, our role is to model what would have happened. And so effectively what we're trying to do is establish what would have happened but for the breach or the negligence. A little bit about legal and ethical. We have to operate within the confines of the law. We're not allowed to do phone hacking and computer hacking and all of those things. I think it's the news of the world have found out to their expense. But actually, there is a more serious note. We've got to conduct ourselves very carefully. We've got to be mindful that we don't compromise the integrity of the whole investigation. If we do something that might compromise the evidence, it could lead to evidence not being admissible. So a key document might be excluded from the proceedings if we've done something inappropriate. And the bits that scare me the most, actually, is if you do something wrong, there's the risk of a professional body investigating you or a regulatory body investigating you. Worse still, a criminal investigation. So it's always good to stay on the right side of the law, I think. And sort of illegal practices. I mean, phone hacking is clearly one. Computer data is an interesting one. Data that an employee processes through their work computer, their own email, etc., is entirely admissible. That is, we can have access to that. There's no problem with that. What we can't do is obviously hack into their private email addresses, even if they may use the work computer to do that. So there is a fine line. I will come back onto the use of emails and the such like, because the one thing that never ceases to amaze me, and this goes for very senior people, very junior people, everybody. If somebody writes a letter, they're very careful about what they write and what they do. You know, you spell check it, you do everything. When people send emails, they send the most inappropriate information. And from an evidential point of view, it's fantastic. And so I was in court 2 weeks ago, and I was listening to one person give evidence. He was a senior partner from another firm of accountants. And they were reading back his emails. And he was clearly mortified at some of the things that he'd written. And even more so, we see people actually, when we're investigating fraud, actually perpetrate the fraud through their email accounts. It's bizarre. You know, it's never lost. No matter how you delete it, you can't lose it. You know, there's going to be a trace of data somewhere. Okay, so I think just focus now on I said that was the more boring bit, but go through a few more case studies with you, because I think this is the best way to explain what we do. This case is a trade dispute. Our client is a reasonable-sized manufacturing company. They have a turnover of something like £25 million and growing. A lot of what they produce, they export. And a significant part of that they export to the United States. One particular product that they export falls within the remit of a, legitimately, we would say, avoiding import duties in the US. One of their larger competitors, which is a multi-billion pound company, objected to this and reported it to the US Department of Commerce, who conducted an investigation. And just to put the context of these parties into some sort of context for you, although our client has a turnover of £25 million, the best way to rationalise it is to look at the situation where you get McDonald's taking on a corner cafe because of the use of a name. It was that sort of proportion. But nonetheless, the US Department of Commerce was obliged to investigate it. The charge really was that they wanted to establish whether our client was avoiding payment of import duty in breach of the anti-dumping legislation that's there. And this legislation applies in Europe, it applies in many other countries. This investigation took over 2 years. And during this 2 years, it meant our client couldn't really export that particular product. So they've lost 2 years' turnover as a result of this. And the reason they couldn't export it was this. What the US Department of Commerce said at the start of the investigation, they wouldn't be looking retrospectively at any damages. So if they did find that our client was in breach of this regulation, they wouldn't impose sanctions on what had gone on in previous periods. However, if they were found guilty, whilst they could still export, the penalties that they were likely to see would have been effectively just over 100% of the value of the turnover. So clearly our client thought it's probably not a good idea just in case to do that. And they effectively lost 3 years' worth of trading on this particular product. They've been successful in the outcome. But what we had to do, it was fascinating really, because we worked with lawyers, it's a UK company, but the lawyers, we had EU lawyers based in Brussels helping us. We had US lawyers based in Washington helping us. So we had this great legal team around us. And what we had to do was basically deal with all the questions and responses that were put to our client by the US Department of Commerce. And it was onerous. It was a combination of accountants and civil servants, I think, who must have written these questions. It was really difficult. And the questions they were asking, for the size of company, our client just didn't keep records like in that sort of format. So we had some real difficulties. But it took a long, long time to get to this point. We then got to a point where they decided they wanted to come and visit our client. So we then had to do a presentation to the officials from the US Department of Commerce. I think our client and the other advisors did a very good job, and I think we felt we'd convinced the people that came through the visit. It still took then another 3 or 4 months for a preliminary decision, and then a few more months before it was a final decision. But it's just something slightly different, a little bit quirky from what we've done, what we've normally do. But it was actually using our forensic knowledge in the context of the petition that was made to assist the client. Just to explain what that picture is, I'm not sure it's right, but apparently it's a fibre optic cable. I think that's what it's supposed to be. But this is a case involving damages. And on this occasion, again, we were instructed by an insurance company who insured a construction company for their liability. So if the construction company got something wrong, you know, if they dug a hole in the wrong road or dug through telephone cables, etc., our insurance client was the party that would have picked up the bill. On this occasion, a major telecoms company had made a claim against the construction company. I think it's probably obvious who the claimant was in this one, given we're in the UK. And essentially what you have, under every city centre and every town, there's a network of tunnels. And these tunnels carry data cables and telecommunications cables that run all the way around, under all the cities. And what the telecoms company had done, because they were responsible for the infrastructure, they had appointed our insurance clients, the construction company, to undertake works on refurbishing these tunnels. Rather unfortunately, the construction company caused a fire. I don't think there's any doubt about it was their fault, despite various denials. But the effect of this fire was to shut down all the data and voice communications in the city centre for a number of days. Pretty catastrophic, given the businesses that are in there. The communications company submitted a very large claim. Part of it was very easy. You know, where they'd had claims from clients under contracts, there was contractual amounts to pay out. That was easy. What was more difficult was the recovery of their overheads, and they have a very complex model for calculating the losses for this downtime. And to say they weren't very cooperative in explaining how they performed their calculations was an understatement. So what our work actually involved, we had to analyse, again, huge amounts of data. We had to verify the accuracy of the calculations. And it was effectively what they were trying to do was recover from our client all the overheads of the business that might have been affected. So, and they had this very complex model for doing that. So we challenged the model. This was a case that did go to mediation, very successfully at mediation as well, and a lot to do with the cost of actually taking it to trial. It would have been a very expensive trial. The original claim was somewhere in the order of £15 million. We actually thought it was probably about £3 or £4 million, and it settled for somewhere between the two at mediation. But it was a very bitter, hard-fought day out. One thing with mediations, it's a bit like corporate finance transactions. They can't settle in normal working hours. They have to settle at 3 o'clock in the morning. I think it's one of the rules of mediation, rather unfortunately. So at sort of 3 o'clock, I was wandering around the streets of London thinking, how am I going to get home? The next case study is a breach of contract that we dealt with. Our client was a consultancy business, or is a consultancy business, they're still going. And they had a very lucrative contract in respect to some major construction projects. And this contract gave them a percentage of the final contract value. But what it also gave them was an ongoing entitlement to income. So it was very, very favourable. I think the other party in the contract probably realised that it was probably too favourable and set about trying to tear the contract up. And effectively, the contract was terminated through a number of breaches. So our clients basically said, well, we've lost future income for the next 10 years, 15 years, whatever the period might be, so therefore we want compensation for that. You've deprived us of our income. The work was still done. They appointed somebody else on more favourable terms. So effectively, what our client was claiming for were financial losses as a result of the breach of contract. But the work we did was twofold on this. We had to look at the breach itself and the termination, because there were a number of clauses that would have entitled the other party to terminate the contract. So our first role was actually to look at the solvency of our client. Were they solvent? Were they technically solvent? And unfortunately, there were a number of issues in the business at the time, so that was quite a challenge. Having dealt with that point, we then had to deal with quantum. And the difficulty we had here was not what would have happened had all the contracts been conducted. It was very straightforward to work that out. One of our challenges, though, was managing our client's expectation. He thought that he would have got every single project going with interest, and actually the reality was that he wouldn't. And so we had to build a model that looked at various scenarios. If this contract did go ahead, what would the percentage probability be? And looking at this, and it became more difficult as you move on into future periods. The matter did go to trial, although the accountants were never called to give evidence. We managed to deal with that in the background. So again, it's a breach of contract case that we've dealt with there. Fraud. Another case studies on fraud. I don't know whether it's just us, but we do seem to find a lot of fraud cases in the motor trade industry. I don't know whether it's conducive to it. And a couple that spring to mind. Actually, I'll just touch upon this one. I don't have a slide for this, but I think it's quite relevant, because sometimes with fraud can happen, and you can be completely unaware of it, and it takes a trigger for something to happen to identify that there's a shortfall. And we were involved in a case a few years ago now, actually, where this dealership group went into administration. And our client on this occasion was the bank, not surprisingly. And they were quite concerned that there was a black hole of money. You know, where's our money gone? You know, we thought, well, we should be able to recover it. And what this business had been doing systematically was, at the end of each month, raising invoices for their corporate fleet customers for a sum of money, and then crediting them on the third of the month. So they were false invoices, effectively. Their facility that they had, the rolling facility they had with the bank, was one that covered stock and debtors. So inflating debtors meant they were able to maintain their facility. The actual underlying fraud that happened on this occasion happened 6 years earlier. And there was a theft of money from the business, and there was a cover-up, but they've been covering up for years on years. And the trigger in this was that a creditor put them into administration. So they couldn't then raise that invoice because they were being run by the administrators. So it's odd. And actually, the monthly fraud that was going on all those 6 years was just a transaction, really, but the root cause happened 6 years earlier. And the other interesting thing about that, again, going back to the point I said about the IT and what people write in emails and the such like, the finance director had kept a very nice record of everything that he'd done in his emails, and it made it very easy. So it's just a note of caution. But the case study that I wanted to refer to here, what our client on this occasion was an underwriting agency. They underwrote insurance for second-hand car dealers. You'll all have seen them, the warranty cover, the gap insurance, these types of things. And they, as with all insurance contracts of this nature, there's a slip that determines the terms of this contract. And the difficulty we had with this was that it was quite a substantial contract, and I think it was worth probably £15 or £20 million over the 4 years that we were looking at. But the individual value of transactions was very small. So, again, it was volumes of data that were our problem. The main issue was that our client was concerned that they weren't getting a proper return of the premium that they'd agreed with the party that was administering the scheme for them, and there were huge losses on the scheme as well. So it was just very bad in many ways. But what we did was we had to analyse this data, slightly different for us because, you know, we're looking at individual insurance policies here. And what we'd identified was that the people who are actually selling these policies on the ground were breaching the terms of the overriding contract. So, for example, as you would expect, there's an exclusion on very high-value cars or very fast cars or just cars that are very expensive to maintain or cars just break down a lot, and there's obviously a few of those that have a track record. And they were being insured. So our client always had an obligation to insure those. So, you know, how do we define what the loss is going to be? And there we said, well, if the value of a contract was £100 for a Ford Fiesta, then for a Porsche 911 it would be quite a lot more. There's all sort of various scenarios for working that out. We also had to look at the accounting data behind all of this, and it was quite correct. It was just an appalling mess, basically. So we had to reconstruct it, and we identified that there was a significant shortfall in the returns that were being made to our client. Again, that did go to court, and you know, our client was awarded compensation on that occasion.
Yes.
Yes.
The one in the US.
Yes.
3 years. They might well have lost 3 years of business, but they must have incurred an awful lot of costs in the expo premises.
Yep. Yep.
Did they get that as well?
Well, it depends. The costs are a major feature. It's a big part of the Wolf reforms and the civil procedure rules. Generally, there's a rule, if you win the case, you will generally, as well as the damages, you will also be awarded costs in your favour, so the other party should be liable for those costs. There are exceptions, though. There are exceptions when the costs are excessive, and we have that. The case I gave evidence in court on just recently, it is considered that the other side's costs were excessive. So even if our client loses, the judge has already said in previous hearings that there will not be a costs order against her for that. So that. And the other thing is, I say that the courts do promote the idea of mediation. So before you even get to court, you're expected to put in an offer for settling the case. You don't have to do this, but you can do it. So if, for example, I was claiming against you and I was claiming, you know, £1,000 from you, you might put what they call a Part 36 offer and say, I'll pay you £500. If that goes to court and I win the case, but I'm only awarded £250. I would be penalised on the cost because I could have taken 500 at an earlier stage and avoided the cost. If it's more, then it would go the other way. So, but costs are a very, very important aspect of, and the costs of going to trial are extortionate. On these types of cases, it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds on legal fees. Not very much on accountancy fees, I have to say, but unfortunately. But it's a very good question, actually. And it is a very significant aspect. And it's something we do with clients at the outset, actually, where we get involved very early, is just look at the cost-benefit. And the other cost that's often overlooked is not the pound notes, it's the management time, because it takes out a huge amount of of management time, which could be better spent running the business. Okay. So on this one, again, we were able to identify substantially what our client had lost through the poor accounting treatment. I don't think we ever got truly to the bottom of it. I think that it was probably more than we could identify, but the bits that we could prove, they were successful in recovering. Just touch upon types of evidence that we look at. We often interview people. We request information from the other side and witness statements. These are absolutely essential. If you've got two sets of witness statements on both sides, one will say one thing and one will say the other, and you've got to try and carve the truth out of that. Accounting documents and accounting records are a huge part of our work. You know, clearly, that is important. But actually, it's not all that matters. And a colleague of mine, he worked on a case for... it was a personal injury case where a lady had an accident and was claiming loss of earnings. And one of the things that she claimed was that she couldn't go out in public, so she couldn't work. And we did a newspaper search, or my colleague did a newspaper search, and we came across her giving a presentation to a room of this size. So there's lots of other evidence that can be used. Public records, very important. Computer searches, Google is our best friend, I have to say. Google's made our life really a lot easier than it was a few years ago. And there's lots of other search databases that you can use. We can use investigation companies sometimes if we need to go beyond that, but again, it's got to be legal and legitimate. And computer forensics is a specialism in its own right. This is where we'll copy computers, take images of computers, interrogate very sophisticated systems, and again, that means we can get to the emails that I've described where people are perhaps a little careless in what they're writing. Physical evidence, obviously it's the paper records, it's the physical assets. On occasion, we have used surveillance information that's been used as well, so the evidence can be quite varied. Look at how do you become a forensic accountant, or what's relevant. There's not really a qualification as such, but you've got to be a qualified accountant, clearly. I'm a chartered accountant, and any one of the qualifications is relevant here. You've got to have the right experience. But to me, the most important thing is the mindset. It's a very different area of working. It's very different to audit. It's very different to tax. You have to be able to work in teams successfully, and it might be remotely as well. You know, data gets pumped around the world. We need to be able to work on that basis. You need to be innovative. You know, clearly, if someone's perpetrated a fraud, it's never going to be straightforward to find it. So you've got to think. We use the term thinking outside of the box, and it's just looking for the unexpected, doing something different. You've got to be resourceful, clearly analytical. And I think certainly in the more early years as a forensic accountant, you do spend a lot of time poring over detail. But even as the partner, as the expert, if a matter goes to court, you've got to have seen everything, you've got to have understood everything, you've got to be aware of everything, because you can guess the one document that you don't look at will be the document you get cross-examined on. Attention to detail. This is by far and away is most important. And actually, our reports have to have the same point on there. You know, things like spelling mistakes and typos can lead a QC to question whether you've really done a proper job or not. If you can't be bothered to write something properly, well, how can we believe your investigation? You've got to be quite quick-minded. You've got to take an unblinkered approach. And I think you've got that broad, holistic approach. Very good organisation skills. You know, clearly, if you are dealing with the sort of volumes of data that I've just described, you can't just leave them in a box by your desk. You've got to be quite careful. A high standard of English. Now, this is really important, and I think that one of the best compliments we get as forensic accountants is where somebody says that they read our report and they understand it. You know, it's written in understandable English. It's too easy to get lost in data streams and very technical terms, because actually the people you're talking to, you know, particularly the lawyers don't understand numbers. I think most of them will admit that as well. So you've got to explain it in a way that's easy to understand and easy to follow. You've got to be adaptable, you've got to be flexible. And you've got to respond. You know, very often when we're dealing with things, new evidence comes to light. You know, our client might not have told us something that's pretty critical. There's usually a reason for it as well. So there's a whole raft of skills, but it is very different to other areas of professional practice. Becoming a forensic accountant, well, the way that I approached it, I went probably the most typical route. I was an auditor to start with, and then started doing a few investigations and then transferred into forensic accounting on a full-time basis. What we are seeing now, we have some of our junior members of the team are actually joining directly into the group, so they are working from day one as a forensic accountant. So rather than going through audit, they will come in directly. The ICAW has a forensic accounting and expert witness accreditation scheme. You've got an Academy of Experts accreditation. There's various accreditations, the ACFE, which is the fraud examiners. So there are various accreditations that you can use. But the real qualification is your experience. I think that's what differentiates you. You've got your instructing solicitors, your instructing barristers have got to have confidence in you as an individual. That's the most important part. I think I finished just slightly early, which probably isn't a disappointment to you, given that you've been sat here all day and all day yesterday. So that's who I am, and thank you very much for listening. What we did on that occasion was that we did have some disclosure of information, and when you read, and some of that included bank statements, so you see references to other bank accounts in there where money's been transferred, so you can be quite specific. And as we'd identified in the legal proceedings that there were these other companies, we made a very legitimate request that we should get full disclosure of information concerning those. Yes, they have to provide. It's a very tedious process. It's very long. Yes, and on that occasion, it was a very slow process. You know, they clearly weren't going to give us everything at day one, and it was drip feeding. And the more we got, the more we asked. And if they'd have been very upfront about it at day one, we'd have had all the information very early. It would have been much more cost effective. But even when the case went to trial, we were still getting information. No, I think, our client was very much of the mindset that they wanted to set the example within their organisation that they wouldn't tolerate fraud, so it was the right thing to do. They weren't minded to convict, to get the criminal conviction and report the matter, and it would appear that the police had never picked up on it either. I don't think it was a necessarily conscious decision or otherwise. I do think, on a personal level, I think it is wrong. You know, when we all get home on a Friday night and you pick up your local newspaper and you find somebody's been sent to prison for stealing a loaf of bread from the local Waitrose, and then you've just walked out of court where somebody's stolen £5 million. I think it doesn't strike me as justice, but there's a whole area about criminal convictions anyway. I think there's...
Right.
The fraudulent accounts? No, I don't. No, I think we just went for every asset we could find. I think that they would just be liquidated. Well, they didn't actually... They did. They would have to account for the compensation, and that's the funds that they got. But there's no restatement because they'd actually overpaid on all the contracts over the years. So the line in the accounts after the case had settled would be income from compensation from the court case.
It's obviously an absolutely fascinating area, and I'm sure everybody in the room would have loads of questions they'd want to ask Stephen. I know I've decided I've been in the wrong part of the profession and I should have been here. It sounds amazing.
It's good fun. Good
but
fun.
Thank you ever so thank much you. For that. That's been absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you. So it just remains to say a few final comments to you all. I'm not going to share any pearls of wisdom with you. I'm sure that you've captured quite enough over the past 24 hours without me adding any more. But thank you ever so much for coming along to the Members' Weekender. I do hope you've all really enjoyed it. What you'll be getting on Monday morning is an electronic feedback questionnaire being sent to you, so please do complete that. One of the things we'll be asking you in that questionnaire is where you'd like the next Members' Weekender to be. So we'll be asking you in particular whether you want it in a city or whether you'd like it to be in the country. So you can decide what sort of scenery you want out of your hotel window. And that will help us in planning next year's event. The dates of next year's Members' Weekender, it's from the 17th to the 18th of May 2013, at which point Henry will be handing over to somebody else, so we'll have to remind him of that, so he doesn't think he's got the gong forever. I need to mention to you that if you have come by car, you need to pick up another car park voucher from the reception on the way out. And if you have had any luggage stored here during the day, you'll be able to collect it from the second floor. But the most important thing I need to do, because you came to this section, this session, this final session, you've actually got a chance of winning something. And so what we have here is some champagne and some business cards. And you mustn't tell anybody in the other session because Mazars are running this one and it's actually them that are given the champagne. We thought we'd hand the prize out to somebody that's in within here. So it's a question of when we draw a name that's actually in this room. Great excitement. So the first name is Mrs. Gail Chubb. No, okay. You've all forgotten that name, haven't you? The next name is Sally Cox. Oh. So congratulations, Sally, with the compliments of Mazars. I was just wondering...
Thank you very much, Steve.
Right. I was just wondering, you know, that question about how many socks do you have to pull out of a drawer until you get one blue and one red one? I was wondering if the business cards are going to be a bit like that. We were going to have to draw out about 25. Anyway, very safe journey home. It's been wonderful to spend the 24 hours with you. It's been fantastic to see the buzz. And I hope you're all going back feeling even more passionate and committed to AAT and with a load more knowledge to enable you to succeed over the next 12 months. So, thank you very much.